Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
What does it say about where we are right now that the nation hangs not so much on the words of the president or the Pope necessarily or the chairman of General Motors, but the guy in charge of interest rates and the money supply? Mr. Bernanke speaks. Were you listening? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, good day to you. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. We made it to Friday. Thanks very much for being with us this 26th of August. An expectant nation. Now, that's a little too melodramatic, isn't it? But certainly Wall Street was on the edge today as central bank boss Ben Bernanke laid out his next course of action. It was, basically, no action, at least for now, on stimulating growth or hiring. Instead, he waded into fiscal policy, which, of course, is not his job. More on that in a moment. But first, we wondered how expectant you've really been in paying attention to all this wonky policy stuff.
The Fed can't do everything. It works in step with Congress, and part of the problem that we're facing right now is a problem with Congress.
I don't think we should jump to anything right now. Things are such a mess that I think that too many people are coming up with Band-Aids.
Making money cheaper is not going to help us at all. It's causing more inflation. We already got food prices going up. Gas is never going to go back down. I mean, print more money is not going to solve the situation. You're just throwing money in a hole.
I'm frankly too naive about what the Fed does to give an intelligent response. I happen to have a friend on the Fed, but I still don't know what the heck he does.
The voices of Steve Longan and Sharon Volkman in Portland, Oregon, Joe Johnson in Baltimore, and Mark Changizi in New York. Mr. Bernanke's message was clear to most of them. Essentially, the ball's not in my court. Our D.C. Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports on how that attempted handoff is likely to go over in Washington.
Ben Bernanke is responsible for the nation's monetary policy. Interest rates, inflation, the money supply. But in today's speech, he focused more on fiscal remedies for the economy, the spending and tax revenue decisions that must be made by Congress and the White House. Alice Rivlin, a former vice chairman of the Fed, knows why.
The Fed's done what it could, but getting the debt under control is a fiscal policy matter. Basically, the chairman is saying, over to you, fiscal authorities, meaning the Congress and the president.
Economists like Joshua Shapiro at MFR Incorporated say finding a way to stimulate the economy in the short run while bringing deficits down in the long run is now up to elected officials.
The level of interest rates is not the issue. Interest rates are already at zero. So it's really in the hands of politicians now, which, judging from what we've seen recently, is not a particularly warm and fuzzy thought.
Indeed, Bernanke criticized lawmakers in his speech for this summer's grueling negotiations over the debt ceiling, which he said damaged the economy. But Bernanke also realizes there are differences within the Fed's own Federal Open Market Committee about how to stimulate the economy. Roberto Perli watches the Fed for ISI Group.
So he didn't talk about specifics, and probably he could not do it. He was not in a position to say anything because basically the FOMC hasn't reached any conclusion.
Which is why Perli says Bernanke announced next month's Fed meeting will last 2 days instead of one. He wants to give board members more time to discuss their next move. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
As anyone in the northeastern U.S. should be well aware by now, Hurricane Irene is headed for the region this weekend. Mayor Michael Bloomberg has already ordered mandatory evacuations for the most vulnerable areas of New York City, something that's never been done before. Sally Herships talked to area businesses about how they're preparing.
Down the block from Marketplace's New York Bureau is O'Neill's Irish Bar. At 2 o'clock, it was packed.
We're New Yorkers. They don't care. They couldn't even spell stress around here, let alone be stressed.
Kieran Staunton owns O'Neill's. He says the kitchen is stocked with extra food. He's also arranged for cars to pick up workers over the weekend. For some retailers, bad weather means good business. Henry Posner works for B&H Photo in Manhattan, purveyor of all things electronic.
People, of course, want to take photographs of both the event itself and its majestic weather-related glory. And if somebody unfortunately suffers some kind of damage to property, they want to be able to record that for insurance purposes.
Posner says in addition to flashlights and batteries, weatherproof video cameras are in his top 5 sellers today. Also popular are hotel rooms in Manhattan. With the New York City subway set to shut down this weekend, even the New York Stock Exchange says it's reserving rooms for employees. But some items are beyond the basics.
Wish we'd figured out where to get sandbags earlier.
Sarma Mengalis owns two vegetarian restaurants. One has a kitchen in the cellar. Every time it rains, it runs the risk of flooding.
You know, in New York City, usually you can make a few phone calls and get anything delivered, but not so sure about sandbags.
Mengalis is planning to run an online special this weekend. The promo code is STORMSALE. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
The White House has just opened a website to public access that's designed to show how well the bureaucrats are putting your money to work. Performance.gov is a clearinghouse of data on federal agencies, bar graphs, spreadsheets, pie charts. Exciting news for nerds, maybe, but how about the rest of us? Here's Marketplace's David Gura.
You may not know this, but the U.S. has a chief performance officer, Jeff Zients.
I work with senior leaders across government to improve the efficiency and effectiveness of their operations and to make sure that every taxpayer dollar is well spent.
He's the guy behind performance.gov,
which is a site that provides a window into the Obama administration's approach to improving federal government performance.
It could become the place to go for answers to questions like these.
How many miles of highway have we built? How many bridges have we repaired? How many vaccines have we delivered?
That's Craig Jennings with a nonprofit called OMB Watch. Now, a lot of the data on this site isn't new, but Carrie Colonisi says this is the first time it's all been available in one place. He's a law professor at Penn.
If you piece all of these things together, you get a picture of what high-level officials in the White House might be seeing when they're managing what's happening across the entire federal government.
The government's been beta testing the site for almost a year now, using it to look for inefficiencies and cost overruns. David Weil teaches economics at Boston University. He says there's a gold mine of data here, if you know where to look and what to look for.
It's always very difficult to translate complex data systems into the ways different users are going to want it.
So if you're feeling like a wonk, the site's live now at performance.gov. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
In the end, Wall Street took a deep gulp and forced a smile today. Details when we do the numbers. Aside from the Fed chief saying, over to you, Congress, in the White House, there was word this morning that consumer confidence is down to levels not seen since November of 2008. And news yesterday of Warren Buffett bailing out Bank of America. Here to talk about the week that was on Wall Street and beyond are our very own New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore and Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal. Good to talk to you both again.
Good to talk to you, Bob.
Great to be here, Bob.
You know, it seemed to me that Mr. Bernanke spoke almost as much today about how Washington needs to get its act together as he did about what the Fed can and cannot do. Sudeep, even though he's out of actual tools, can his addressing the gridlock in Washington be considered a new tool? And how powerful might that be?
Well, the Fed chairman does have some effect in terms of a bully pulpit in shaping expectations and driving the debate in Washington. Unfortunately, though, we have such a toxic political atmosphere right now that it's not clear how much it would matter. A lot of what Chairman Bernanke said during the debt debate was actually ignored. But this all does help focus the attention on the fact that we'd have fundamental problems, and he can point to those. Those problems have to do with taxes and trade and education. And the Fed shouldn't deal with those and can't deal with those. And so he's at least helping to draw the focus and attention where it needs to be.
How do you like that double take Wall Street did this morning? The Dow dropped like 200 points because it didn't like the message at first. And then it bounced back up as if to say, gee, he says it's not all that bad. What's going on there, Heidi?
Well, I guess Wall Street realized that they already have the best of all possible worlds, and maybe they should stop complaining. 0% interest rates for 2 years and two more years of it to come. What more can the street ask for? This is what's been driving stocks and so high. Obviously, this week or this month accepted because we've had the whole debt downgrade issue and all of that. But, you know, Ben Bernanke has measured his performance by the performance of the markets, and the markets essentially love him. They have to love him. They've never had a better advocate.
I know what more we could ask for, a better economy. Sudeep, consumer confidence is now the worst since November 2008, but I read that Tiffany's profit jumped. How does that work?
It is kind of baffling right now. One of the things we're seeing is that a lot of the problem in consumer confidence is actually tied to the debt debate, tied to the battle in Washington. And as we've seen that heat up, consumer confidence has fallen. With some of these company earnings, it's really very interesting. Tiffany's, Williams-Sonoma, both places selling luxury items, they've been doing quite well. Lazy Boy Furniture said its customers were gravitating toward upholstered furniture rather than leather. They're trying to stay toward the cheaper end. And so this kind of mirrors the split in the overall economy since the recession. The stock market, despite its recent trouble, has done relatively well, and it's up pretty strongly. But regular consumers and regular workers just aren't doing very well.
Heidi, I've got to ask you. Yeah, go ahead.
No, you can probably also get a better price on gold at Tiffany's than you can on the market, right? So why not?
I've got to ask you about the new Bank of Buffett. I think everybody's still trying to figure out who got the better deal there, Bank of America or Berkshire Hathaway. But does it really matter if perceptions shifted here? I mean, you filed a pretty dire assessment of B of A's future this week, Heidi, and the next day it was all better?
Yes. Isn't it amazing? The power of unicorns and sparkle dust. Well, it is the power of perception, which is the thing that has been ruling the economy and the markets. Having Warren Buffett behind you makes you look strong, even if the whole world knows you are not in good shape. So Bank of America has a strong franchise. You know, a lot of people have checking there and credit cards and so on, but it's mortgage reserves, its litigation problems, all of that still hover. But if Warren Buffett stands there, all of a sudden his shadow blocks what's behind him, which are those shadows over Bank of America's future.
Heidi Moore at the helm for us in New York, and Sudeep Reddy from the Wall Street Journal. Enlightening as always. Thank you both.
Thanks, Bob.
The strife in Libya could all too quickly become a humanitarian crisis, and the rebels there are pushing urgently for the nearly $110 billion in Libyan money frozen in banks across the world. The U.S. already has announced about $1.5 billion has been freed up in American banks, but the big push to aid the rebels has come from overseas. Europe's larger role in Libya even prompted one of President Obama's advisors to describe the U.S. approach as leading from behind. That phrase sparked an ongoing conversation about the U.S. role in foreign conflicts. Here's commentator Parag Khanna.
Leading from behind seems like a paradoxical approach to handling grave strategic situations like the Arab Spring, but it has no doubt worked in Libya. To be sure, it is also a misnomer. American drones patrolled the skies and identified targets. American diplomats and military advisors have been meeting and coordinating with the Libyan opposition, the Transitional Council, for months. So in terms of hardware, the U.S. wasn't so much behind as doing the heavy lifting in the rear. Still, we must remember that Europe, too, was in the lead. France was the first government to recognize the Transitional Council. That was a bold move, taken when the ultimate outcome was far from certain. But Libya is Europe's strategic backyard, and Europeans made clear that it was time for a changing of the guard. But not being out in front did something else. President Obama forced the Europeans to finally come to terms with their lack of military hardware and preparedness for this kind of conflict. Remember, Europe has been saying they would unite to confront such challenges for almost two decades since civil war ripped through the former Yugoslavia. And fortunately for everyone, they finally did. 2 months ago, NATO was still unclear as to who sat atop the chain of command. But quickly, operations, plans, and missions came together to tactically back the rebels town by town, from the air and sea. This was, in important ways, a template for potential future operations. First, Western on-the-ground commitment was minimal. There was not a single Western military casualty. Second, we took sides. There were and still are rifts among Libya's rebels, but NATO supported an array of them from across the country. Third, rebels did the storming. NATO helped them help themselves. All of this may seem obtuse. Why not just force Gaddafi out back in February and avoid thousands of civilian casualties? There isn't a good answer. But Libyans' perceptions of the West might be very different if we hadn't let them own their revolution. That might be the most important aspect of leading from behind.
Parag Khanna is a senior research fellow at the New America Foundation. You can take the lead with a comment of your own at marketplace.org. Coming up, summer is a busy season for Chinese factories, but what happens when there's not enough juice to meet demand?
We run 24/7, and when we are suddenly cut off, that means people have to go home.
Not yet, though. First, let's do the numbers. It took a while for it to dawn on Wall Street this morning that Fed Chair Bernanke was reassuring us that America will see long-term economic growth. The Dow Jones Industrial Average climbed 134 points, 1 2/10%, to close at 11,284. The Nasdaq gained 60 points, 2.5%, to finish at 2479. The S&P 500 ticked up 17 points, 1.5%, to end the day at 1176. Volume was lighter because many traders had already fled Hurricane Irene. For the week, the Dow hopped up 4.3%. The Nasdaq skipped up 5.9%. The S&P 500 jumped 4.7%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.19%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on personal income and spending for July. The United Nations marks International Day Against Nuclear Tests. And the annual Burning Man Festival gets underway in the Nevada desert. This year's theme, Rites of Passage. Burning to go? Only if you've got a ticket. It's sold out. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon, in for Kai Ryssdal. The other day in our letters segment, a listener pleaded for more positive reporting, please. Truth is, we never shy away from constructive stories. Like this one, a new nonprofit is launching an innovative fellowship program aimed at smoothing the way for business startups that can help turn our economy around. Much like the Teach for America program, which places recent grads in teaching jobs where they're needed, Venture for America seeks to put fresh talent to work with a salary for small startup companies in struggling cities. Its founder, Andrew Yang, joins us from New York and from Massachusetts, Harvard senior Gabby Bryant, who's among the first Venture Fellow applicants. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Andrew, first to you, why the need for an organization like this?
Well, over the last number of years, I've personally encountered hundreds of enterprising 20-something-year-old recent college graduates who desperately wanted to themselves become engaged in startups and entrepreneurship and learn how to build businesses and create jobs. But there was no easy pathway for them to access those sorts of opportunities. And I'd personally experienced that myself. When I graduated from college, I also was interested in startups and started my own company when I was 25 and saw just what a difficult road that can be for a recent college graduate.
Now, the three cities that you're sending students to so far are Detroit, New Orleans, and Providence, Rhode Island. Why those cities?
We think that those cities represent the new American frontier. They're where both the opportunities are and where the need lies. Those cities also have the huge advantage of having tremendous entrepreneurial ecosystems. They each have a dozen or more thriving companies that are all hungry for talent that we can send our fellows to support and contribute to.
Gabby Bryant, let's turn to you. You're from one of those cities, Detroit. If you could go back there as a venture fellow, what would you hope to do?
Detroit has really been hard hit. In the past, Detroit's really been known for the car industry, but it's such a harbor for talent in music and in art. I think that things like that need to be expanded, and it needs to be a place where artists can just express themselves and make the city a better, thriving place.
And how does this program lend itself to being able to do that sort of work?
The main reason that Ventures for America really impressed me is because it brings young people and it shows them how to make your own startups and how to bring jobs to a city and how to create an active place for people to live and want to be in.
Andrew, back to you. Give me a couple of examples of companies that want to take on some of your venture fellows.
Sure. In Detroit, there's actually an entrepreneur named Philip Cooley who has just opened up a 28,000 square foot warehouse that's going to be a community startup space. And Philip and his brother Ryan are actually going to hire one of our venture fellows to become their lieutenant in helping them build out that space. So that's exactly the kind of opportunity that Gabby's looking for.
This impresses me in a business sense as sort of a Peace Corps for entrepreneurs, if you will.
Yes, that's exactly the idea. And as someone who's run a company myself, I know how difficult it is to find good talent. But it's doubly difficult if you're a startup that's strapped for resources and you're in a city like Detroit or New Orleans or Providence.
This is not some sort of glorified internship kind of program.
No, if you're selected for the fellowship, first, we expect to have thousands of top applicants applying for 50 fellowships. So it's going to be extraordinarily selective. If you're selected for the fellowship, you will then come to Brown University next June for a 5-week boot camp where you'll meet with experienced venture capitalists and entrepreneurs. And then you spend 2 years at the company as a fellow, working full time.
Gabby, I have to ask, you're graduating from Harvard University with a degree in economics. I imagine you're going to be getting plenty of well-paying job offers. Why do you need something like a Venture for America?
I don't have a lot of that real-life experience in a startup company, and the best way for me to get that is by throwing myself into a real-life situation. And especially because Detroit has such a special place in my heart, it's really important for me to be able to give back. And I think I'm in a special position because that is my home, and I've gone off to Harvard and have this great education to come back and help the city in a way that people from necessarily the outside may not be able to do.
Gabby Bryant is a senior at Harvard University and an applicant to the Venture for America Fellowship Program. And the founder of the program is Andrew Yang. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thanks.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
The rapidly rising consumer class in China is now voraciously burning through roughly half the world's flow of coal. Imported coal prices are soaring because the Chinese are buying so much of it. And it still hasn't headed off the worst energy crisis to hit China in years. The workshop of the world is turning off the lights, and rolling blackouts mean doing business in China is increasingly difficult. Our China correspondent Rob Schmitz takes to the factory floor to bring us this report.
Morten Vikan came from Norway 8 years ago to run this plastic injection mold factory here in the Yangtze Delta. The plant works around the clock, making parts for iPhones, GM sedans, and Philips coffee makers. But in the summer, temperatures rise, and the rest of China turns on hundreds of millions of air conditioners. They suck up what's becoming a dwindling energy supply. China's National Grid Power Company has told Vikan and tens of thousands of other companies here to expect losing power twice a week through the summer.
The problem is that the planning. We run 24/7. And when we are suddenly cut off, that means people have to go home. So if we are lucky, they will tell us on Wednesday afternoon that Thursday and Friday there is no power for us.
Vikan says they gave even shorter notice during last year's energy shortage.
They call you 10 minutes before and say you have no power, cut down.
Vikan says this is a big problem. Summer is the busy season for Chinese factories trying to pump products out for the winter holidays. But China's struggling to feed its own increasing appetite for energy.
The price of coal on the international markets has risen far above what the Chinese government will accept that it can pass on to its consumers.
That's Bill Dodson. He's the chief editor of ChinaEnergySector.com and author of the book China Inside Out. Dodson says there's more to this energy shortage than, well, a shortage. China's power companies buy coal at market rates, but China's government forces them to sell power to consumers at artificially low prices, prices that don't cover their costs. So they just turn the power off. Why does China's government insist these companies sell power at bargain basement prices? Dodson says there are three reasons.
Social stability. So if energy becomes more expensive than consumers are comfortable with paying, they will actually protest. They will come out onto the streets. And that really is one of the last things that the central government wants.
At Morten Vikan's factory, he's waging a protest of his own. He's so fed up with electricity outages that he's bought 2 diesel power generators. Now he'll just have to worry about the rising price of gas. In the Yangtze Delta, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
A final note, I was reading about a young investment banker a while back complaining that he works such long hours with so little time off. His hourly pay rate works out to less than he could make at McDonald's. And now comes a survey from the headhunting firm Capstone showing growing disenchantment among junior bankers. Seems 67% aren't happy with their pay and are looking to leave investment banking. Now, this is only a hunch, but I'm just guessing there are some other unhappy Americans who might be wishing those bankers did have enough time off to get out and see Gordon Gekko in last year's Wall Street movie sequel.
Hey, stay positive, pal. Don't whine when it hurts. It's like the first grade, Jerry. Nobody likes a crybaby.
And just remember, it's Friday. And that's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow climbed 134 points, 1.2%. The Nasdaq gained 60 points, 2.5%. The S&P 500 ticked up 17 points, 1.5%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is Deborah Clark. J.J. Yore is vice president and general manager. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, the lousy economy gives you lemons, make lemonade, right? Except that adage is tasting a bit sour for a couple of young entrepreneurs.
The first year was really nice. We got lots of money, but then after that, when the economy started to go down, we didn't get as much money.
I'm Bob Moon. Kai's back from vacation Monday. Mine starts right now. Thanks for being with us this week. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.